Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
With the contract, right? Our no booze contract.
Yes.
Is that, we didn't actually state that it was 100 days consecutively. So as long as I do 100 days sober.
Buddy, we mentioned that the 28th of April is the day that you can drink again, which is 100 days from when we set it.
I don't think we did that.
Yes, we did.
We didn't do it before we shook, at least. So.
Yeah, we did. We shook, and then we said we shook.
I'm just looking for wiggle room.
You ain't got any. Hey, listeners, welcome to a Friday episode, by the way. Alex, if you haven't listened to our bonus episode, we have made a bet with Alex Mitten that he's going to do 100 days sober. Whoever loses has to pay £1,000 to charity, a charity of the person's choice.
Mm-hmm.
My charity choice is my bank account.
Yeah, I'm going to quickly set up a charity.
But we're going to do that. And you're 100 days sober. Alex then sent me a message last night with a picture of a non-alcoholic beer saying, yeah. Suck on that.
Yeah, just showing you what I've got.
And then when we walked up the stairs to do the podcast, he went, 100 days is going to be tough. It's only been 2 days. It's been 2 days.
Yeah, it's going to be hard. Look,
what do you mean it's going to be hard? That's what alcoholics say. It's easy.
It's nearly the weekend. I can feel the energy, the vibes coming back in.
What you do is this.
Yeah, what do I do?
You do this. You get drunk. You wake up. You feel bad. You feel terrible about yourself. Oh, I'm never drinking again. You say that, and then you get to the weekend again.
You do the exact same thing. Also, I was with Robbo last night. Told me you were bitching about me turning up hungover to this. So you can.
You did turn up hungover to this.
Yeah, I know.
I wasn't bitching.
It became part of my character, all right? I had to keep it up.
I was not bitching. I said, yeah, he turned up hungover.
Don't you ever go behind my back again, because I will.
I'll say it on the podcast. You did. Everyone knows.
I'll say it on the podcast.
Everyone knows you turned up hungover that time. That was fine, though.
Okay.
It wasn't bitching.
Well, anyway, it's still going strong. Day two. I'm really. I'm killing it.
I'm crushing.
Shut up. Why are you looking at me like that?
You know everyone's talking about you.
What? Can you turn the lights down in here? Anyway, it's going really well. We need to intro the podcast rather than just talk about ourselves.
We are going to. We also, don't forget, for bonus episode, we have our wedding planning section back on. Sophie is going to come on and we're going to talk about what location we're going to have the wedding.
I can't wait for the suggestions.
Yeah, so waiting for the suggestions. If you haven't sent in a suggestion, we're going to literally consider them. Contact Private Parts Podcast.
We are literally going to consider them, which basically means we are not going to fucking consider them.
These guys are going to be the first to know where we're going to set our wedding. It's very exciting.
Okay.
And the date and everything. So if you want to get in contact with us, contact@privatepartspodcast.com or slide into our DMs @privatepodcast. Please let us know what you think and join us on Wednesday's bonus episode. Soph, come on, she's going to be there, Channing Wedding and sort of stuff like that. Okay, today's episode, we have Ed Winters. Earthling Ed. Now, obviously, it is January. A lot of people are doing veganuary, becoming vegan. Now, this is a great episode. We have a great debate. Whether you're vegan or not, you're going to love this. You very much hate animals
with a passion.
I have a vegan company. I love the idea of being vegan. I'm a flexitarian.
That was purely financial, though.
I'm a flexitarian.
You saw a gap in the market. You realised that it was going to be the only financial... viable thing. Oh, shit, I need a drink. I need a fucking drink.
But it was, and I very much challenged some of the views, or tried to challenge.
What you'd done is you'd Googled quite a bit of stuff beforehand and then just kind of regurgitated it. Just so there was a counter argument, which was good, because otherwise I feel like we would have just agreed.
You had to have a counter argument. You very much sat on the fence, as you do.
I didn't sit on the fence, actually. I was, I believe, Ed. I was with Ed.
You were with Ed.
Snuggled up in an avocado having a... having a cucumber water. I was on his side.
Was it comfy in there?
Oh, it's fucking creamy. It was real good.
Avocados are terrible for the planet.
Yeah. The cartel is also like avocado wars because it makes so much money.
Throwing avocados at each other.
Yeah. It's a real guacamole. There's probably a joke in there somewhere.
He's back. He's back. But it's a very interesting debate. And I would be interested to know what your thoughts are on this. If you think that we... had a good debate, if it was interesting, whether you were going to be turning vegan after this, whether you're not going to be turning vegan. Mm. I just think it's interesting to talk about this kind of stuff. So hopefully you enjoy it. Ed Winters was an amazing guest. Ed, thank you so much. That his book is out. So you go and check it out. This is Vegan Propaganda. It's a great book. We're going to leave the links below. Enjoy this episode, this Friday episode, for everyone out there.
We're talking veganism. We've got some other guy who clearly has no idea what he's talking about trying to counter his argument. It's enjoyable. I sat in the middle of it all.
Ed Winters on the podcast. Enjoy. Do you know what is interesting about this episode today? We have done, I reckon, maybe 600 episodes of Private Parts. Maybe a surprise to you if you ever listened to it. I've never prepared anything for any episode.
Really?
Yeah, I've never prepared anything.
I don't believe that.
I promise you, I've never prepared anything. And Ed, today I slightly looked at some notes. Yeah. I slightly went over some different things. And actually, for the past week, since I knew that we were having you on, I looked at all your interviews, all your YouTube channel, your podcast, whatever it was. And before we start, I just want to say I admire you so much because of your patience.
Thank you, Jeremy.
That you have in these situations. It's even now when you sit here, you're waiting for me to finish, where I would talk over someone straight away.
Sure.
Where does that patience come from?
I think that's just common politeness.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
It's common decency.
You're just a rude arsehole.
All right, shut up, you wankers. All right. Jesus Christ. I was trying to be nice. Where does that patience come from?
I think it's practice. I'm very aware that when I talk about issues like veganism, of course, it's a hot topic and people are very opinionated about these issues and people have a lot of views about them. And so I'm hyper aware that if I don't respect people and don't listen to them and don't give them a chance to express themselves, then the conversations I have are just going to end up in arguments and they're not going to get anywhere and it's all going to be pointless. Because, you know, people have this impression of vegans, whether it's right or wrong, that we're militant and dogmatic and extreme and all of these things. I used to think the same thing. So when I have conversations, I'm very much of the impression I don't want to perpetuate that idea of vegans. So that's where it comes from,
I guess,
really.
It's like the same with environmentalists as well. Sure. If you go in too hard with someone, it almost pushes them the other way. And then, you know, you're not going to even meet in the middle ground. They're going to go, well, fuck off.
Like, exactly.
If you're coming at me aggressive, like, so I can see why you've had to pick up that patience.
Definitely. It's a work in progress, you know, work in progress. Don't get me wrong. Sometimes someone will say something and I'll think, well, that is the craziest thing I've ever heard. You know, people, yeah. Honestly, when it comes to veganism,
clenching your fist.
Internal fury, yeah. But I'm totally calm.
I want to see in your home life where you just go nuts. Break just
smashing cabbages.
Punching pillows.
But Ed, your name is Ed Winters. Your nickname or your kind of sort of name that you run by is Earthling Ed. And for people, a lot of people know who you are. I know who you are. Alex knows you are. The team here all know who you are. But for people who don't know who you are, can you explain your beautiful story that you have about your journey and where you got to where you are now?
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously I'm vegan now and my life's work, if you like, is revolving around, you know, talking about veganism, spreading the message, trying to influence people's behaviors towards veganism. But I wasn't born in a vegan family. Sometimes people have this impression that to be vegan means that you must have been raised in a family that were at least sympathetic towards it. But mine weren't and still kind of a little bit more iffy about it, right? So I was raised just eating meat, dairy, and eggs every single day, never questioning it. And then in 2014, I came across this story And it's a sad story, but it was a poignant moment in my life because the story was about a truck carrying around 6,500 chickens. And the truck had crashed on the way to a slaughterhouse near Manchester. Mm. And I remember reading this story and feeling very horrified because the journalist was describing what had happened to these chickens. Hundreds were dead, hundreds more were running into oncoming traffic. And for the first time in my life, I ended up sympathizing with chickens, which whoever does that, right? No one sympathizes with chickens. Mm. And yet I'm 18, 19 years old, thinking about these chickens and going, oh, hang on a minute, something's wrong here. But KFC was my favorite food back then. I loved KFC. I used to go twice a week. The workers at my local KFC knew my name. So I had this little bit of rapport with my local KFC workers. And then all of a sudden I'm feeling sorry for these chickens who I was eating twice a week, you know, sometimes three times a week. So I reached kind of, pardon the pun, but like a fork in the road. And I realized that my values and my actions weren't in alignment. Now in Britain, we are, you know, proudly a nation of animal lovers. We always talk about that. And I'm the same, and I was the same. I always thought, you know, people that harm animals, that's a terrible thing to do. But then I thought, well, hang on a minute. Am I inadvertently through my choices harming animals? And so I went vegetarian. And then I watched a documentary called Earthlings, hence where the name Earthling Ed comes from. And the documentary just, I mean, it's not a nice watch. It's an objectively very graphic, horrible watch of what we do to animals. And afterwards, I was feeling very upset. And I had a little pet at the time called Rupert the hamster. And so I went and sat with Rupert the hamster after this film had finished. And I was looking at him. And Rupert the hamster loved broccoli. It was his favorite food. Absolutely loved it. So I got him some broccoli from the fridge, gave him a little bit of a floret.
Did you cook it? Or was this just straight raw?
He's like super, he was super healthy.
Super vegan.
Raw vegetables, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly right. So I gave Rupert some of this broccoli and I watched him munch away on it. And I'm thinking, wow, you know, Rupert has all these likes and dislikes. He also hated kale, right? What sort of hamster doesn't like kale? I thought, you know, that would be a staple, but he didn't like it. And so I was thinking about him having these likes and dislikes and this personality. Mm. And I just thought about all the other animals and how they have likes and dislikes and personalities. And we use this word sentient to describe them. Sentient meaning conscious, you know, having the capacity to experience, to feel, to have emotions, both positive and negative. And then I thought, what about the animals who I pay to be exploited on my behalf? Should they be factored into my moral consideration? And that's what led me to veganism, ultimately.
It's an amazing story. And one which I always admire people when they're passionate about things, whatever that is. Doesn't matter if it's water skiing, veganism, or going to the gym. If you have a passion, I think it's amazing. And you're obviously incredibly passionate about it. But you obviously are, you know, you're faced with a lot of opposition.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of the time, right? And rightly or wrongly, you are. Now, in this conversation we're going to have today, right, I'm probably going to say things that are stupid. And if I do, tell me that they're stupid. Or if I say things, and I like kind of... having a debate about this, because you have to be sort of not confrontational, but you have to get into these debates. Have you always been someone who likes debating?
No. I hate confrontation.
Really? Same. Because yeah, you're now known for almost being confrontational, where you turn up to rodeos, or you go to you know, farming gatherings and things like that, and you question these people who are there. But if you're not used to that and you shy away from that, that's quite a hard thing to change as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, I don't like confrontation. I don't really like arguing with people. And I think interestingly, that's probably led me to kind of more of this stuff that I do now, like these table debates where I go to universities and just set up a table and invite conversations, because I just want people to, I just want to have a friendly conversation. Now, I like
people. It's quite hard to get punched over the other side of a table.
You've got a little bit of a leeway. At rodeos, it's a little bit more, you know, they live a little bit more violently by nature, don't they, over there? So yeah, I think it was just a case of me wanting to be with, I like people, I'm a people person, and I like interacting with people. I enjoy people's company, even people I don't know. And so having these conversations about veganism, I really like it because I get to know people and I get to know people's feelings and beliefs and values, and I get to pick up on their behaviors. And I just really enjoy that aspect of what I do. And so it's not, I try to avoid the confrontation aspect of it, but undeniably there's always going to be confrontation when talking about big, you know, moral issues, which of course this is. So yeah, it does happen.
But it's funny, because I then watched this one where you did, it was a hunter versus a vegan, and it was this lad Bible thing. And you're actually quite kind towards the hunter, because the hunter actually, in my opinion, didn't quite know what they're talking about. And you always encouraged the conversation. It was almost like a teacher trying to help her answer your questions. You were helping along. So I suppose, which you've probably never been asked, because people sort of attack you and maybe sometimes they would think that you attack them. If you were going to argue against yourself, is there anything that you can possibly think that you would go, oh, okay, this is the argument against veganism?
I've thought about this a lot. I always try and do like the stress test with my arguments.
Yeah, because
you know?
That's a good way to test things, right?
Absolutely. And you know, I always think that the thing I feel most sympathetic towards people about when it comes to this issue is people's accessibility, you know? And I think that obviously veganism is an issue because it's now, we now have a choice, you know, we have the option to be vegan or not vegan. Whereas in the past, we didn't necessarily have the option to choose plant-based foods because they weren't as available, weren't as accessible. So I always think that we need to strive to make veganism consistently more accessible, more available for people, you know, the plant-based substitutes more affordable. So in terms of an argument, there's no moral argument that I have found so far that goes against veganism, but a societal argument would be that we still need to make it more available and accessible for everyone in society. Mm. You know what I mean by that?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean, but I think that's hard. Some people believe that being vegan is like an elitist point of view, right? Because it's hard to become. It's expensive. It's definitely a way of life. I was listening to your podcast with Jay Shetty, and you know, there are all the things, and you can mention them much better than me, that the sort of, when you become vegan, you have to be careful about, you know, your iron intake. You have to be careful about your zinc and and things like that. And there are supplements you can take. However, you're having to take these pills or supplements. There's something called Krona, which you mentioned, or where you can judge the calcium levels.
Oh, Kronometer.
Kronometer, exactly. So you're living a life. It's a way of life.
Well, it's a lifestyle choice, but so is eating meat, dairy, and eggs. And I think what I like about veganism is there is this attitude of scrutiny about it. So when we talk about nutrients, you know, iron and zinc, you should be aware of, but you don't need to supplement iron and zinc. You can get them from plants easily enough. So it's just a process of education. And even with that point about it being expensive, you know, sure, if you want to live off Beyond Meat burgers, that's going to cost more than, you know, buying cheap beef burgers. But at the same time, you can also afford very cheap vegan foods like, you know, fruits and vegetables and brown rice and pastas and potatoes and lots of staples, which are also the healthiest foods, you know, incidentally as well. So you can be an expensive vegan, but you can also be a vegan on a budget. And nutrients wise, you just have to be educated. But I think the trap that we fall into is thinking that if you eat meat, dairy, and eggs, therefore you're getting all the nutrients. But actually, many people are nutrient deficient when they eat meat, dairy, and eggs because we're just not educated enough about where these nutrients come from in the first place.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I think it's quite interesting placing veganism in like modern culture, like placing it against this ultra meat heavy world that we've lived in, and looking maybe at what like the history of veganism was and how that existed previously.
Yeah.
Do you know much about like kind of where the first sort of the idea of living a vegan lifestyle kind of came from?
Well, it depends how you define veganism. Obviously, throughout history, there have been cultures and communities who have abstained from eating meat. And, you know, we look at Jainist cultures, Buddhist cultures, Hindu cultures. But in terms of like vegan being an ethical, philosophical stance, it kind of really emerged in the early 20th century in the UK. A guy called Donald Watson was part of the Vegetarian Society. And he said, well, hang on a minute, you know, what about dairy and eggs? We should do something. And the society, the Vegetarian Society, said no. So he created his own society and called it veganism because he took the veg from vegetarian and then the A and the N from the end of it and said, let's cut out the middle and just go straight for vegan. So that's kind of where it originated in terms of being like an ethical, philosophical stance, not just a religious thing, but saying, I'm not going to eat animal products because of this moral, the moral implication of continuing to harm animals, if you like.
Yeah. I guess because when you, as I was talking about contrasting it to modern society, it does seem like kind of an extreme thing to do. But actually, if you were to go back, you know, hundreds of years, it wouldn't maybe be seen as extreme, because I feel like we as humans have taken, as we do with everything, we've pushed everything to the limit. And I think, you know, veganism in its current form has maybe been born out of a recognition that we're kind of fucking everything up. The way that we farm everything, the way that we do everything is just so detrimental.
Yeah. Also, I think we should probably lay out our stances where we
are. Yeah,
because that's it. So I would call myself a flexitarian.
Sure.
Okay. I mean, that's basically saying like you're
That's not what people call you behind your back. Just to let you know.
I have a sweet company, Candy Killings. We're completely vegan. The reason why we became vegan is because we wanted to make the best sweet possible. And we thought, for the cash. And we thought...
We thought
removing animal gelatin, all the sort of bad ingredients, that was making it a better product. And so that's what we wanted to create. I haven't removed meat totally from my life mainly down to pleasure, I would say.
Sure.
Sensual pleasure, right?
Sensory pleasure.
This is the one that we can talk about as well. And Alex, you're the kind of same. I would say that you sort of flex between the two.
I mean, I'm probably further towards vegetarianism and veganism. I rarely eat meat. Like, I probably eat it like...
But you eat fish, right?
I eat fish, yeah, a bit, not loads. Not loads.
See, I don't eat red meat hardly ever. Mm. I eat chicken. I eat a lot of fish.
Sure.
Fish is my main source of diet, I would say. And it would struggle to cut out. My sort of thing is this. You're saying farming is ruining land. So this is my point that I want to try and stress. And also, I'm just here. I don't have a view. I'm more excited for you to educate me.
Sure.
Yeah. Right. But I think it's important in these situations to possibly throw in a debate rather than just one-siding stuff, right?
That's what I do.
That's what you do. So get ready for you to be beaten.
Yeah, exactly. Earthling Ed owned.
Yeah, here we go.
Jay, I can't wait for your input here.
Okay, but it's true. Okay, so the point is right. Okay, if we look at farming, for example.
Sure.
What you want to do is you want to educate farmers to sort of change the way that they farm and to farming crops rather than farming animals and things like that. That's the sort of idea, and educating them towards that. When farmers farm a field, right, when they sort of sow a field or whatever it is, they the amount of field mice that are killed, the amount of bugs, the amount of maggots within cow pats are in the... It's within the thousands. Mm-hmm. So, and if a farmer then sends his cows in the pasture to slaughter, that's maybe hundreds or whatever it is. So the amount of bugs and field mice and things that are being killed when a field is being sown is far more, it seems like. So where does the arbitrary line stop? Is a cow more important than a bug because you can see it and feel it and understand it and touch it and it produces milk? So where is the line? Does that make sense?
I kind of have two things, but you go.
Okay, go. Was that total nonsense? Or
No. That's actually a very educated, very sensible argument.
Great. Okay, we're in.
So let's see how we can deal with it. So I think the first thing to consider is, well, the field mice one is a little bit of a red herring. You know, if you try and catch a mouse, they're going to get away from you. So a big combine harvester coming across the field, most of the larger mammals, you know, the rodents as well, and the birds are going to clear off pretty quick. But the insects is absolutely true. Of course, insects are going to get, they're going to get macerated by a lot of this equipment. But at the same time, what we have to consider is that animals who we farm are also fed crops as well. Even grass-fed animals who are out in pasture are often supplemented with things like hay and silage, which is basically grass that's grown in fields and then, harvested and dried and then used as food. So when you look at land usage, the majority of the land that's used is used for animal farming, even when it comes to cropland, for example, as well. So even if we make the argument that all these insects are killed, well, they're more still killed for the animals who we consume, because the animals who we consume are also fed plants as well. And I think when you said about cows, you said hundreds. Well, it's millions in the UK alone, billions when we look around the world. So actually more insects are also killed in the production of plant foods for animals than they are plant foods for humans. But beyond that point, I think the interesting thing of what you said there is, how do we rank life? Mm. That to me is a really profound and great question. Now, for me, I look at life and I base a moral consideration on sentience, that word I used earlier. Mm. And so if I put it into a perspective or into like a scenario for us, you know, you may have heard this in one of the interviews I've done recently, but let's say we have a burning building, and in that burning building, you have a human and a dog, and you can only save one life in that dog. In that building. Did you say dog? Okay, all right. Well, many people might
do. If it was
do.
Jay, yeah. I'd probably save the cockroach.
But typically, people would say typically the human,
say,
right?
Yeah. Typically, they say the human. And so you could find reasons why that would be morally justified, right? But the point in that is, it's not just then justified to harm a dog normally. So we can create distinctions on life based on things like sentience. So let's say that we have a situation where there's a cow or an aphid or a green fly or whatever it is in a burning building. We'd opt to save the cow because we recognize that the cow has sentience, the capacity to experience emotions. Their life has more value to them than the aphid does to the aphid. So you can create distinctions. So if we had to choose between killing, you know, animals like cows, pigs, and chickens, or killing insects to farm them for crops, even outside of the context of more insects being killed for animals currently, even outside of that context, you could still find the moral distinction that makes killing the insects worthwhile, you know, more morally justified than killing the animals we currently kill to conventionally consume.
Yeah, but does that argument work? Because then you're still picking
but
sides, right?
We have to eat, and we can't live a morally puritanical life.
Yeah,
and so what we have
to
do
achieve.
Is choose a way of life that reduces suffering the most. That's the important question.
This is what I was going to say. I think it needs to stop being so black and white. And it's maybe a slightly utopian way of looking at things. Sure. But it's like about readdressing just our respect for animals, for nature, for everything. And in doing so, we will minimize death and there will be less of a deficit.
I don't know why I'm sticking to this. I have a vegan company, right? I'm for veganism, but I just think it's important because it's just important to have this conversation. But we want to educate people. And I think you use that word the whole time, educating people on what we can do differently and how we can help things, you know. But if you look at sort of, you know, farming cultures or farming industries or farming families that have done it for generations, that's the only thing they know.
Sure.
What you're doing, you're asking them to completely change their business model. And if you go to someone like Dyson and say, well, okay, we don't want you to do any fans anymore, we want you to start selling swimming pools, they wouldn't be able to do it. So therefore, they would be out of jobs. So I don't think you can educate people to farm things differently because it's actually pivoting a complete business.
But it's not as much of a pivot as the example you used there. What we have is a situation where farmers are basically meant to be stewards of the land. You know, that's their primary focus. You know, stewarding land and providing for human society. That should be what their aim is. But what we have right now is an industry that's not stewarding the land, is ravaging.
Monoculture farming is just like basically destroying everything because it's not natural to have one crop over, like, you know, millions of hectares of land.
I mean, even just recently,
it's terrible for the soil. It also takes all of the carbon out. There's a really good documentary.
Yeah, takes out the nitrogen and things like that. Yeah, so we're not putting back enough nutrients
in. There's
a
really good documentary about this California couple that they move out of the city and they want to set up a farm. So they get the specialist who is a polyculture specialist.
Sure.
And they basically speak to a lot of farmers in it. And the argument is that actually, if you can create this harmony, this polyculture harmony, where you've got all of these different, you know, crops and animals all living in a particular space, it actually kind of, it works for itself. And also it's more profitable. And you also set, you know, you back yourself because if for example, you've only got one crop and there's a drought or there's, you know, disease, then your year is fucked. Whereas if you've got 30 different crops, you're kind of like, you know, you're covering your backs. So they're saying that if they can revert to a more sort of, you know, ancient way of farming, which is this polyculture way of doing it, then it will be a lot more profitable. Yeah. It's just trying to get out of these old models newer models of doing things where they have to spray so much, pesticides and stuff to keep the crops going because they've just ravaged the land so much.
But then what you're telling people to change your whole culture.
Necessarily. I mean, it's about this notion of suffering. And so I think what we have is a situation of farming where it's maximizing the suffering that's being caused, but not for any great benefit for us. In fact, the detriment of our species with the environmental degradation that comes as a result. Now, I think that there is this idea that vegans want all animal farmers to switch to plant farming, but that's not strictly the case because the last thing we need is to take all the farmland that's currently used for animals and grow plants. And we don't want to do that. Mm. What we want to do is something called rewilding the land. So rewilding means taking farmland that's currently used and returning it back to nature. So that could be reforesting, creating peatlands, wetlands, wildflower meadows, long grass pastures, whatever it may be. And so what we can do is we can incentivize farmers who are currently grazing animals on this land to instead return that land back to nature. Now, what we have to bear in mind is we subsidize farmers by billions, with billions of pounds every single year.
Explain that a little bit more.
Absolutely. So subsidy is a taxpayer's money. So when we pay our taxes, a portion of that money is given to certain industries. It's given to fossil fuel companies. It's also given to the agricultural industry as well. Mm. And the purpose of that is to drive down the cost of production so that we can maximize the amount of food that we produce and make it cheaper and more affordable to produce. As a consequence, cheaper for the consumer. But what we have is a system now where we're subsidizing farmers so much that 90% of the profits of grazing animal farmers, so that's cattle farmers, sheep farmers, 90% of their profits is coming from the taxpayer. And those products are still expensive to buy in a supermarket. So this is not an economically viable system without the help of the taxpayer. So what we need to do, in my eyes, is still subsidize these farmers, but give them the money they're currently given to rewild that land. You know, rewilding increases biodiversity. It means we can absorb carbon, sequester carbon from the atmosphere because we've got trees and, you know, wildflowers that are good for pollinators and all of these things. And so when we talk about changing culture, we're not asking farmers to no longer live on their land. We're not asking them to move into cities and work in supermarkets or any of that. We're asking them to keep living off the land, but do so in a better way for all of us, which undeniably a system that's more focused on nature than on production must be.
I can imagine a lot of the farmers would actually probably welcome it because it sounds like the industry is really struggling to keep up. Like if 90% of their profits are coming from subsidies, then it's obviously an industry that's not working, right?
Yeah. But people are stuck in their ways, right? It's very hard. And that's how you're stuck in your way. I'm stuck. You're stuck in your way. We are stuck in our ways. And it's very hard to create that shift.
Absolutely. Yeah.
From your side, Ed, okay. Did you become vegan because your love for animals, or was it because you couldn't justify why killing animals was right in any way?
Yeah, people have this idea, I think, that to be a vegan means you have to have this compassion towards animals that's almost unnatural or abnormal, you know, or you must really like animals. The truth is, I don't think I know lots of people who like animals who say they would more than I do. You know, I don't like snakes, but I don't want people to just go and harm snakes. So for me, veganism isn't an issue of compassion, it's an issue of justice. And so what I mean by that is, if we leave today this podcast studio and we go out for a walk and we come across a dog and we don't kick that dog, that's not us being compassionate. So in the same way that if I can avoid putting a pig in a gas chamber or paying for a cow to have their throat cut, I don't view that as compassionate because I think it's just the right thing to do from a justice perspective, not to put someone, you know, a sentient being into a situation where they don't have to be placed into that undeniably causes them harm and suffering and robs them of their life. It's a culturally learned behavior to view some animals as being food animals, some as being pets. So, you know, we do have this, you know, paradoxical attitude towards different animals when morally a dog's capacity to suffer and feel love and all these things is more or less the same as the pigs, at least in a way that makes, you know, them both morally relevant. So it is an arbitrary cultural distinction that we've created. It's not grounded in anything that makes any real sense because for one animal, we love them as a family member. We mourn them when they die. We grieve their loss. But then for another, we, you know, raise them in farms where we mutilate them. We put, you know, mother pigs in things that we call farrowing crates that they can't even turn around in for weeks at a time. And then we kill them in gas chambers. You know, over about 90% of all the pigs in the UK are killed in gas chambers.
Wow.
You know, so what is the moral distinction between a dog and a pig that makes that acceptable for a pig, but the, you know, not acceptable for a dog?
I think going back to the compassion thing, I think a lot of us are still very compassionate. I think it's just the fact that it's so dislocated. Like people don't know or see this.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
And if they saw it on a daily basis and they saw the pigs being treated that way, they would probably stop.
Yeah.
It's just because it's presented to you as like
people don't choose to.
It's very easy to not, right?
Yeah, but people choose not to, right? That's the whole point. There's actually like a syndrome, I think, where people actually choose to deny that thing because if they know if they actually saw it, then they wouldn't actually approach the situation.
Yeah. It's like willful ignorance, isn't it?
Yes,
we maybe deep down think, oh, you know, maybe I shouldn't be supporting this. But as you say, there's labels and there's adverts on TV and we've been raised to believe it's normal and acceptable and fine. So we don't want to dig any deeper and go, hang on a minute, you know, should I be paying for this to happen to an animal when I don't have to? Like, how do I justify, you know, paying someone to lower a pig into a gas chamber when I can buy something else instead? But that disconnection, as you say, Alex, so perfectly, is what I think drives so much of this industry.
Oh my God. Honestly, I'm so psyched on this podcast. We're going to have to stop there for part one. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about your book. Yeah. Can't wait. I want to talk about laboratory meat.
Oh, you're good. Yeah,
and
nice.
See your view on that and so many other things. Don't, you can't go anywhere.
No, I'm stuck. Hostage.
Yeah. Stuck in the cage that we're in, and we're all naked. So we'll see you in part two.
Okay.
Okay. See you in part two. Bye bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.